Texas Business Minds, a presentation of the Business Journals of Texas. Brought to you by Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies build a stronger, safer Texas. In this episode, Will Anderson closes out his career as ABJ Managing Editor while taking the reins as Dallas Business Journal Editor-in-Chief, welcoming J.B. Milliken, Chancellor of the University of Texas System.
Chancellor Milliken, thank you so much for joining us on the Texas Business Minds podcast. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Good to be with you.
Great. You are the Chancellor of the University of Texas System. Now, that has 14 academic and health institutions across the state, including 7 medical schools. Now, it's based in Austin, but because of the 254,000 students that are enrolled and the 116,000 plus employees, this is a system with a statewide impact. In many cities, it might be the largest employer or one of the largest. Obviously, a hub for research and innovation in many places. So I'm sure our business audience is eager to hear about what's going on.
Great. Happy to talk about it.
What is the state of the University of Texas system? Why don't we start high level?
Okay. Well, you mentioned 14 institutions, 7 medical schools. We just opened our 7th medical school this summer in Tyler. The idea was to address an area that had significant healthcare needs and not enough doctors. Opened a class to 50 students, and 48 of them are from the region in East Texas. So far, it's tracking exactly as we hoped. So that is terrific. Also in East Texas, we just assumed the control of Stephen F. Austin State University this summer in August. So that made our 14th campus. And we're excited about all the things we're doing. I was on a call earlier today. I'm chairing a search committee for the next president of Stephen F. Austin, its first president in the University of Texas system. But it's a longstanding university celebrating its 100th anniversary this year and has great tradition. And they're keeping their purple.
I was going to say, so no changes to the color of the mascot. Alumni will be happy about that.
No, they're the Lumberjacks and they're purple.
So as you alluded to, it stretches from East Texas all the way to UT El Paso in the far west, down to the Rio Grande Valley, Austin, where you are, up to North Texas. Previously, you were at SUNY, the City University of New York. Is that correct?
Except it's CUNY, City University of New York. SUNY is everything outside the city, and CUNY is everything inside the 5 boroughs. So it's 25 institutions within the 5 boroughs of New York.
That is a very urban system, and now you're in a very spread out state, many different communities, different time zones. I wonder what it's been like leading that.
Yeah, it's obviously very different. CUNY is the most urbanized university in the country, and a very kind of different makeup of the student body and campuses. There's 7 community colleges within the 25 institutions, so quite a bit different. Of course, there are a lot of similarities in all of higher education. Before I got to CUNY, I was the president of the University of Nebraska for 10 years, which is my alma mater. I grew up in a small town in Nebraska. And before that, I was in Chapel Hill at the University of North Carolina. So just to continue on beyond Stephen F. Austin and the new medical school in Tyler, to set the stage for, you asked for kind of an overview of the UT system. We just emerged from a legislative session. In financial terms, the most successful by far in the history of the university in terms of state support. Operating support, a new record from the state. It will allow us to not increase tuition for 2 more years. So this will be 4 straight years of no tuition increases across the university and no increases in mandatory fees. The state also invested over $550 million in CHIPS, including $440 for UT Austin to build a new semiconductor fab and to do research in the area to help cement Texas's role as the leader in chips manufacture and research and employment in the country. We have some stiff competition on that. But of course, as your listeners will know, this is an industry that is very heavily concentrated in Taiwan. And it's an important both geopolitical but also economic interests of Texas to create a major hub here. And so we're We're working hard on that. The state also invested several hundred million in space. We have a burgeoning space industry, both private in Texas, but also the NASA Johnson Space Center. And we do a lot of work in space medicine and in every other area related to space travel. So this is another important marker, I think, for the state of Texas to be the leader in the country in this area. So many other initiatives and support that came from the legislature and the governor this year. So it's it positions us well for the future.
Let's use that as a leaping off point, because I don't think there's a hotter industry than semiconductors, or it's up there, rivals the hottest industries. And as you said, the Texas Ledge set aside a few hundred million more dollars for the Texas Institute for Electronics, which I believe is a UT-led partnership with semiconductor companies, other academic institutions. Tell us your role in that at the UT system and what it's going to mean for the economy.
As you say, the Texas Institute for Electronics, something we kicked off last year together with President Hartzell at UT Austin and Senator Cornyn and Representative McCall, who joined us for that launching. This will be the centerpiece for our efforts, but we have institutions, UTEP in El Paso and UT Dallas and UT San Antonio and UT Arlington, which will be participants in this effort as well. There'll be a lot of work for a lot of institutions, both researchers and for educating students who will work in this burgeoning industry, and we hope help Texas be the leader in the world.
Is this like a modern day equivalent of the MCC? So for longtime Austinites, that was the Microelectronics and Computer Consortium, which for a lot of folks put Austin on the map for technology and helped attract companies. I think even like AMD and Samsung, that, you know, what the MCC started in Austin helped later attract chip companies. I wonder if we see similarities between the Texas Institute of
Electronics. I do, and I appreciate your drawing on that history, because we do hope that it will have the kind of impact that MCC had. We have a number of the leading industry partners in the world joining with us. So I see this as a parallel, and I certainly hope that it has the same kind of impact that the MCC had, which, as you say, put Austin and Texas on the map in electronics. I think this is a similar kind of a launch.
And of course, we'll have a statewide focus too, as you alluded to, with multiple institutions. I wonder if in Austin, though, if the old MCC building, I don't think there's any, if that's been discussed as a possible landing place for something like this. There's that old MCC building off MOPAC. I believe that's UT system property.
We do have plans to develop a number of our properties now, including off campus for the fabrication facility. So I can't tell you how excited all of us are that this came together, both with the federal support, which is significant, and I hope that we can attract a significant share of that as well.
There's that old Semitech plant owned by UT Austin in South Austin as well, so we'll have to keep our eyes on and see how those real estate plans come to fruition. Let's keep talking about workforce a little bit, because I think the UT institutions obviously are known for great, you know, four-year bachelor programs, but of course, so much discussion now is moving toward the workforce aspect of higher education, making sure that people come out of school of higher education ready for the jobs that are available today. I've seen plenty of news out of the UT system of partnerships with Coursera, with Google, so students can earn certifications while they're studying that can help them in the job market. But I wonder if you can tell us your philosophy and your thoughts on that, because the UT system is known for a high level of, you know, academic rigor, but the conversation is shifting so much now around what higher ed should really mean when it's getting you ready for a job.
I think that's a great question. We'll back up just a second. We are still looking at enormous growth in Texas. You know, a few years ago, people were talking about 20 million more people over 20 or 30 years. So we have a lot of growth coming. It's a good problem to have. It's one that many states in the upper Midwest and the Northeast don't have, and their institutions are struggling. We will always have a need for four-year degrees, for masters, for PhDs, for the kind of knowledge milieu that higher education is in Austin and in other places. But we've also seen an increasing focus on these micro-credentials that you referenced. We started a couple of years ago, coming out of the pandemic, really, something called Texas Credentials for the Future. And we look at this in several ways. One, it's an opportunity to provide our matriculating students, our four-year students, you know, you could be in business or you could be in the humanities or you could be in science. But if you can get a certificate in one of many different areas, right now we're heavily focused on IT-related areas and cybersecurity and business-related areas like project management, so that our students can leave not only with a grounding that will support them during their entire career development, but also be job ready for positions that are significantly attractive in the marketplace today. We're way underserved in Texas and in the country, as that goes, for people who are prepared for entry-level jobs in cybersecurity. So we have pledged to educate a huge number of cybersecurity graduates, both from our traditional programs, but also these short-term credentials, whether it's a 12-week boot camp in cybersecurity or something else. So we look at it as a way to bolt on a credential, which makes our graduates increasingly attractive in the marketplace. But it's also, it does a couple other things, in my view. One, you know, we have 40 million people in this country who have some college credit and no degree. 10% of that's in Texas. And for a variety of reasons, higher ed across the country has not been very successful getting these people to come back and finish their degrees. They're in careers, they have families, they're maybe place bound. So this is an opportunity, I think, where people can take online a short-term credential and either be prepared for an entry-level job or advance in their career. The final thing, point of this, I think is important, is that we know people change jobs many times during their career now. No longer the case that many people work 40 years and get a gold watch when they leave. So how do they prepare for that next job or that next promotion? And I think these short-term credentials and certificates are going to be a great opportunity for that. We hear a lot from the private sector. We had a conference not that long ago in Dallas, co-hosted with Southwest Airlines and Texas Instruments and AT&T, and had about 100 employers and people from our institutions that are involved with this. And there's an enormous amount of demand for these kinds of credentials, either for college graduates or for people who may be coming out of community colleges or directly from high school. You mentioned Google and Coursera. We're the number one partner with Google right now in the country. I was in Washington 2 months ago with the CEO of Google to announce a new program for the University of Texas system with Google, and we're Coursera's number one partner in offering these industry-recognized credentials for our students, which we provide at no cost to our students now under our support of the Coursera arrangement.
Oh, interesting. So that's free for students at the UT system.
And we've been in it a short time and we had 6,000 students sign up for it right away.
Well, I want to come back to costs of higher ed in just a second, but I just want to point out that there is this very interesting shift that you kind of reference, and it's this idea of lifelong learning. It's not go to UT Arlington, UT El Paso for 4 years and then never see it again. It's something that as we get into an economy where there's lots of mobility, lots of changing jobs, as you say, there might be periods in your life where you need to go back and get a certificate or brush up on a certain area in order to improve your economic prospects.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I look at this, I think we will continue to evolve into a situation where it's almost like a subscription service where our alumni, once they, you know, where should they go get the next upskilling that they need? Well, they ought to come to their alma mater, a place that they know, they're comfortable with, et cetera. So, you know, I'm hoping UT graduates in the future, when they're looking for a way to get a specific skill, will have the opportunity to get that from UT Austin, a place that they're familiar with, they know the quality, et cetera. That is not a market that we should cede to proprietary institutions where it has resided for the most part in recent years.
J.B. Milliken joining us. Next, he addresses the price tag of higher education when Texas Business Minds continues.
This year at Texas Mutual Insurance Company, we're celebrating 25 years of dividends and a record $340 million dividend distribution to Texas businesses. See how business is better with Texas Mutual at texasmutual.com/dividends.
Let's go back to a topic that you were just addressing, and that's the cost of higher ed. Obviously, it's ballooned. Everyone can see the charts and talk about how quickly it's risen in places. But I've heard you discuss before about a tuition level that's below the national average for the UT system institutions. And I just want to give you a chance to talk about where you think price of higher education sits, what you're trying to do when it comes to making it affordable to a wide swath of people.
Well, one of the things that gets lost in the, not in your coverage, of course, but in some media coverage, is the difference between the price and the cost to particular students. So there's a price tag, there's a tuition rate, whether it's at Harvard or whether it's at UTEP. And then there's the price that students pay. And one of the things that we've been trying to do is drive that cost that students shoulder down. So 2 years ago, the Board of Regents adopted the Regents Promise Plus program and set up an endowment of about $370 million. We had already a program in place with UT Austin for about $170 million. So almost $500 million or so in this program now, in an endowment that supports each of our institutions and allows them to use that to defray the costs for families below a certain adjusted gross income. So if you're at UT Rio Grande Valley, which is a kind of our poster child on for this program, if you're from a family with $125,000 or less of adjusted gross income, you pay zero tuition and zero mandatory fees. That's 90% of their undergraduate student body. So that's one of the ways that we are controlling and actually driving down the cost that we can control. You know, we can't entirely control the cost of living in a place like Austin, which has increased probably about as much as any place in the country. We are taking steps by building more housing for students and for faculty, because it's one of these markets that is experiencing now what places like Palo Alto, New York City, Santa Barbara have experienced in the past, where freshly minted PhDs, junior faculty, have great difficulty being able to support the cost of living. And so this is all part of our effort to keep the cost down, to be able to recruit faculty to Austin and our other cities, but also to keep the cost down for students. And we will add more in the future to the Promise Plus program, but we've seen dramatic consequences from it already. UT Permian Basin grew 12% this year in enrollment, 10% last year. And they attribute much of that to this Promise program, providing free tuition and fees to a much larger group of students.
How does that work if, like, in a situation where, say, 90% of students don't pay anything? How do the financials work on that?
The interest on the endowment that the board set up is supporting that cost.
It's now, a one-for-one kind of replacement where, it's endowment money that's set aside to basically take the place of tuition money.
It is, and I don't want to misstate this. When we did the Promise Plus, we required that each institution have their own Promise program in place. So one or two didn't have one. There was already a program at Rio Grande Valley, which was pretty generous, out of 65,000 or below, something like that. So what we were able to do with those institutions is add to it. And we didn't supplant their resources. We said, you know, you have to keep your commitment and we will add to that commitment. And that will make a difference for many more students.
I want to talk a little bit about your career. Like we were saying, at CUNY, where you were the chancellor before, your stops in Nebraska, your alma mater, UNC. Did you always see yourself as a higher ed administrator? I wonder, you know, what convinced you to go down this path?
I did not. I started as a Wall Street lawyer, and after doing that for a number of years, which is a career that I actually enjoyed a great deal. It just was something I didn't want to spend the rest of my life doing. And through a set of really circumstances that you couldn't predict, you couldn't chart out, I ended up in my first job in higher ed. I'd worked on Capitol Hill before I went to law school, so I had a little experience with Congress, and then I had experience in the private sector doing securities law. So I went to a university and started using the kinds of skills I had from those earlier careers. And one thing led to another. I discovered, I wasn't sure I would stay with that, but I discovered that, one, you can have in public higher education such an enormous impact. 70% of the people who are educated in this country are educated in public institutions. And I see it now. I wish I'd thought of this before I did it and had a great origin story. But I sort of only realized it after I started working in higher ed, that it is the way to take a talent, which is universal. But the opportunity often isn't. People didn't have family members that went to college. They don't think they can afford college. They have no experience with it.
So level that distribution of opportunity to.
It's a way of matching, I like to think of it, opportunity with talent. It is a great, at its best, it is a great social and economic engine, an engine of mobility. And many of our institutions, Wall Street Journal had UTEP number one in Texas and in economic mobility. U.S. News and World Report had several of our institutions led by UT Rio Grande Valley as the leaders in the country in economic and social mobility. So being able to do that and have a kind of impact at scale in a place like the University of Texas system with a quarter of a million students at any day enrolled is it's a remarkable experience. And I'm incredibly fortunate to have found that and to have been able to enjoy a career in it.
I don't know what you're talking about. That's a great origin story. That's a good one. Hey, let me fit one more bonus question in, Chancellor. What's the best class you've taken or taught?
The best class I've taken?
Or taught, yep.
Or taught. Well, you know, the ones I've taught are extraordinary classes. but I'm not sure if you took a poll that you'd get the same result. Now, you know, as an undergraduate, I had a terrific experience in a large public university where an advisor, terrific, talented, decorated professor agreed to be my advisor. I'm not sure why. What he did was guide me through the course book. That's when we had newspaper kind of magazines with courses. Nobody enrolled now would know what that is. But he directed me to different faculty members. It almost didn't matter what they taught. And I found that to be, created a remarkable experience. And I would trade it for nothing. So I'm not sure I would say the best course, but I can certainly name a whole bunch of faculty members that changed my life. And that I would recommend to anyone.
Someone who took a vested interest in your development as a young person.
Exactly, exactly. And we know that providing adequate advising is key to student success. There are a lot of components that contribute to student success, but adequate advising is one of those. It's one of the programs we put in place in CUNY at a huge scale, which became a national leader and doubled and tripled graduation rates. And one of the key factors was advising for students.
Chancellor Milliken, thank you so much for joining us on the Texas Business Minds podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for downloading Texas Business Minds, presented by the Business Journals of Texas. Brought to you by Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies build a stronger, safer Texas.